Very good, thank you. So it's the theme of the program here this semester is all about active matter. So some of the material I'm going to tell you about is active and some of it is not, but hopefully some of it will be relevant to our conversation. So the question is, topology refers to microstructure. Different materials have microstructure. Now, Christina asked me to make a little bit of a pedagogical introduction to topological defects. Last time I was surveying the group, we had a lot of biologists in the group. So the question is today, do we have some biologists? Is everybody here a physicist? Some people are, everybody is a physicist, so you may know all the pedagogical stuff I put in here, so we might be able to skip some of it. So defects arise in all kinds of material that has structural order. Okay, so for instance, in a crystalline solid, we might expect dislocations, grain boundaries, vacancies, interstitials, impurities, cracks, steps on free surfaces, all kinds of things. Okay, and the mechanical properties, including yield stress, ductility, brittle versus ductile behavior, all kinds of things, and in particular, transport, all depend on microstructure. And this I learned from hanging around with metallurgists. And so, for instance, one of the types of defects you'll see is a dislocation. For those of you who are not into defects in solids, here's a little movie of how an edge dislocation nucleates from a free surface and glides across the crystal, thus translating the top half of the crystal with respect to the bottom half by one lattice unit. And you can see this previously vertical line has now been split in half, and there's been, you know, a shear by with the translation of one lattice unit. So edge dislocations can glide under stress. They create defects on the surface, and then edge dislocations and screw dislocations added together can create grain boundaries, and other types of defects you might find would be this grain structure. Now the word defect sounds like it's something bad, but it is not something bad, because without defects in crystals, the gold ring I've been wearing for many years would be too soft to wear. I mean, if you made a single crystal gold ring by annealing it to get rid of all the defects, it wouldn't actually be very useful as a piece of jewelry. So defects are everywhere, and including in soft matter. Okay, so defects have a topological charge, which is characterized by a Burger circuit. And even those of you who are a physicist may not have seen this before, because in the solid state textbooks, there's like one page about dislocations. Metallurgists study them for weeks and years. So a topological charge of an edge dislocation, if you start here and make I always like to tell the parable of the traveler in a new city. If you take a taxi from the airport in the middle of the night to a new city, and you go to sleep in your hotel, and you wake up in the morning and you say, I want to know something about my neighborhood. You get out of your hotel, you take a walk. Imagine these are streets, right? And you walk 1, 2, 3, 4 blocks east, 1, 2, 3, 4 blocks north, 4 blocks west, 4 blocks south. And you're like, where the heck is my hotel? It's not here. I can't find it. And the answer is one of those streets ended in the middle. Okay, that's the edge dislocation. And the difference between where you started and where you ended is the Burger's vector. So here the Burger's vector is horizontal. The defect itself is a line that's here that represents the edge of that three-dimensional half plane. Okay, so for an edge dislocation, the Burger's vector is perpendicular to the sense of the line. If this were, for instance, a three-dimensional system. So it's a point defect in 2D, it's a line defect in 3D. And dislocations can parannihilate if the sum of their Burger's vectors is zero. So here you have kind of a topological charge that's represented by the Burger's vector, and they can add and subtract. So you can take one plane and break it into two half planes, spread them apart, and you have a plus one and a minus one. Likewise, you can take a half plane here, and if you had another orphan half plane over here, you can combine, or this one, here's a half plane, combine them together and get rid of them. Okay, so the same thing happens in soft matter. So liquid crystals are non-spherical molecules. They form mesophases that have different degrees of order. In case we had a biologist here who didn't know anything about liquid crystals, I drew some sketches of some simple liquid crystal phases. So for instance, at very cold temperatures, you would expect a crystal. Nice, it could, whatever unit cell it would have. As you go up in temperature, you might find a tilted smectic. So this is a still layered structure, but it's disordered in the plane. The molecules have a net tilt with respect to the layer normal. At a higher temperature, you might find a smectic A. That's an untilted smectic. So each of these is a two-dimensional liquid. If you pulled it out like a drawer from a chest of drawers here and looked at it from the top, you would see liquid-like order. Okay, going up in temperature, there's the pneumatic phase, which has orientational order, but no translational order at all. And at high temperature, you would find an isotropic phase. Okay, so any of these phases can have defects. So first of all, the crystal structure could have dislocations. It could have an edge dislocation where there's half of a layer. It could also have a screw dislocation. So is anybody parking in parking structure 10? Does anybody have a rental car? Right, or you're parking structure 10. What happens if you make a circle in parking structure 10? You go up one level, right? So in the screw dislocation, the Burger's vector is actually parallel to the sense, because if you make a circle that encircles the defect, you go up or down one level, right? So Smectic can have edges or screws, Smectic A or Smectic C. There's another kind of defect that you can put in a liquid crystal, which is a discolination. Okay, and you make a different kind of Burger circuit. You have to go around, but instead, let's see, this is a little long. It would help if I used a pencil, maybe. You can take a something small, point it in the direction of the defect. We'll do this one. This is a plus one defect. You start here, go around, and as the pen circles in the plus theta direction, the pen itself turns in the plus theta direction by 2 pi. So we call that a plus one defect. Okay. The minus one defect is here, and as the pen goes around following the direction of the spin, the pen rotates in the minus theta direction by 2 pi. We'll call that a minus one defect. Okay. So this is a topological defect that could occur, for instance, in a Smectic C liquid crystal, the one that's tilted. If you pulled that layer out from the drawer, like a drawer, and looked at it from the top and represent the tilt direction with an arrow, you would see defects of plus one and minus one in a layer of a Smectic C. Okay. Smectic A doesn't have this kind of defect because the molecules are standing up. So it has to be the tilted one that forms this kind of defect. Okay, a pneumatic liquid crystal can have a plus one half or minus one half. The two ends of the molecule are more or less equivalent symmetrically. So you can take your pen and notice that it only goes around by pi. So that's plus one half and that's minus one half because the pen goes the other direction. Okay, so those are different types of topological defects that can occur in soft matter in a liquid crystal phase. Okay, now there are some nice ways to study that. So for instance, if we were looking at a freestanding Smectic film, just a few layers stretched across a hole in a glass slide. This is actually a simulation because I don't do experiments, so I'm just showing you a simulation of it. You can take it through a Smectic A to C transition. So when you first go into the Smectic C phase, the spins or the molecules might be, see, I think of them as spins, but the molecules might be tilting in random directions, and as the system evolves in time, they will form a population of defects, which will paranylate until none are left. This is what it looks like when viewed through cross polarizers. Okay, you see four dark brushes indicating it's a plus one or minus one defect. So the if you have a polarizer and analyzer, there are two sets of cross, you know, two polarizers, one vertical, one horizontal. And so you can actually see as the system goes around by 2 pi, it gets dark and light four times. To tell the difference between a plus defect and a minus defect, you have to actually rotate the sample between the polarizers, and defects of opposite charge counter-rotate. One rotates right and one rotates left, so you can see. In this particular case, this is a simulation. It's not done on a square lattice. It's actually done on a random mesh. There's a little bit of randomness or roughness in the pinning potential for the defects, so they haven't all annealed away. It was annealed quite fast, and so you can see it's stuck with some defects, and there's a plus minus pair, and you can see that their brushes connect. So that's the signature of topological defects in a tilted Smectic. Okay, so that's the kind of thing you would see in the experiment. Okay, now I'm a statistical physicist. What's the easiest way to study this class of topological defects, say in two dimensions or in a curved geometry? We have our very, very favorite, it's almost like the fruit fly of statistical physics, the XY model. It's kind of like, well, maybe the Ising model is the fruit fly of statistical physics, but it's very similar. Okay, so the idea is we're going to put an array of little spins on a square lattice. We're going to assign each spin a variable name SI, which is a spin that points somewhere in the XY plane. Okay, and the interaction looks just like the Ising model actually, with SI dot SJ means adjacent spins like to point in the same direction. The energy is lowest when they point in the same direction. So there's some energy cost associated with forming a defect, associated with the variation of the direction of the spins. And in fact, a plus spin and a minus spin have an energetic interaction which is attractive. Energy favors their paranylation. So the energy goes like the log of their separation distance, and the driving force pulling them together goes like 1 over r, where r is their separation. Now, what's cool about this system is, statistical physics, there's this wonderful second order melting that happens for the XY model in two dimensions. You might know it by the name Kosterlitz-Dallas phase transition. Maybe you learned about it in STAT-MET class. So in the high temperature phase, we expect a lot of unbound plus and minus defect pairs sort of wandering around, a gas of positive and negative charge. They nucleate as pairs, they annihilate as pairs. At low temperature, you would have thermal activation of a positive and negative defect here and there, but they kind of are bound together and they nucleate and annihilate but they never get very far apart. So this Kosterlitz-Thallus transition is an unbinding of the defect pairs. This is actually a pretty darn good representation of the smectic C liquid crystal in the sense that it generates these defects. The elastic constants in the liquid crystal can be different for different types of deformation like twist, splay, and bend. But if those three elastic constants are all the same, this is an approximate way of describing the system. So you can use this model to study defects and how they annihilate. If you want to study a pneumatic and you want defects of charge plus 1/2 and minus 1/2, you can make a little tweak to the XY model. All we do is instead of having a spin S that points in the XY plane, we'll have a pneumatic director N. The difference between a spin and a pneumatic director is the pneumatic director doesn't have a head or a tail. The head and tail are equivalent. Okay, so in order to make a change, we'll do ni dot nj squared. So this is completely invariant. Any spin can be made into the minus of the same spin, doesn't matter. Right, and this system can form defects of charge plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. And again, at high temperature, you expect still plus 1/2, minus 1/2 pairs to be everywhere. And at low temperature, they just thermally activate. But they have, let's see what's special also about the low temperature phase. There's no real long range order, there's only quasi long range order. But it looks pretty ordered in the simulation. So the question is, what happens if you put the XY model on a sphere? We're going to talk about defects and curved geometries first. So here's a simulation, incompletely annealed, of the smectic C-type liquid, which is really the XY model on a sphere. It's put on a random mesh on the sphere. So there's a little spin. You can see it's sort of got a little dot on its head, so you can tell the difference between the head and the tail. Do you see some defects? I think I marked them. So first of all, here's the random mesh. We constructed the random mesh using random sequential absorption. It's just a simple way of generating a random mesh on a sphere that's not crystalline. We put the spins on, let the system evolve. Let's see. So if you take your pen and study, you can see this one's a plus one. It goes around like that. This is a minus one because it goes whoop like that. And this is another plus one. Okay, so the question is, can you get rid of all the defects on the sphere? And the answer is no, you cannot, okay, because of the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. So I think we have to look at a picture of a coconut. Okay, so the story about the Gauss-Bonnet theorem, there's no way to comb the hair on a coconut without at least two topological defects, and they're both plus one defects. For those who grew up in the United States, there's a popular old television show called The Addams Family. And on The Addams Family, there is a character named Cousin It who has so much hair that it hangs over his face as well as over the rest of the sides and the back of his head. And if you look at the very top of Cousin It's head, there's a plus one defect. Okay, and if Cousin It curled himself up into a ball, so all the hair at the bottom, you know, went in, it would still be a plus one defect. So he has the topology of a coconut. Right, you cannot get rid of all the defects on a plus one on a sphere. And so the Gauss-Bonnet theorem tells us that the total topological charge of defects on the coconut is 2, I don't think I wrote it down, 2 minus 2g, where g is the number of handles on the body. And this is a sphere, so it has no handles, so g is 0, so you have 2. Okay, what if you have a donut? Here's a donut. So we put an XY model on a torus. That'd be a pretty funny looking stuffed animal to have a furry donut shaped toy, but I suppose you might do it. And so the question is, well, how many defects does that have to have? And the answer is, well, it has one handle, so g is 1, 2 minus 2, g is 0. So you can have a completely defect-free vector field on a torus. Okay, with all the, for instance, all the spins could point, you know, going in the around direction or pointing into the donut, you could have completely defect-free. But when I annealed this thing, it did not anneal. Couldn't get rid of all the defects. Why is that? The plus defects tend to stick on the positive Gaussian curvature part of the system. The minus defects tend to stick in the negative Gaussian curvature of the system. They are separated. So it's a phenomenon that the curvature acts like an external potential for defects. Positive defects and the negative defects are drawn to different parts of the surface. So it's hard for them, in spite of their attraction, to annihilate. They get stuck. The total has to be 0. So the other one is hidden where you can't see it. But the total is 0. Good question. So the interaction I'm using, instead of, since it's a three-dimensional object, we still use an interaction of the XY form in three dimensions. So two spins that are neighbors, if you have a cylinder, for instance, the lowest energy state is for all the spins to point parallel to the long axis of the cylinder. The short axis has higher energy because they're not really parallel, right? So that's where the interaction between the defects and the curvature comes from. Okay. So what this is telling us is that curvature acts as an external potential for the defects. The defects will migrate in response to differences of the curvature. Okay. So now I'm going to switch gears. Instead of talking about liquid crystals, I want to talk about lipids. These aren't very active. This stuff is we're going to get to pneumatic elastomers in a few minutes, which really are active materials. But in this case, I'm going to look at two analog phases to the smectic A and smectic C. So the untilted L alpha phase is what's sometimes called the liquid crystal phase of a lipid. Okay, so here's a cartoon lipid. It looks like a lollipop. It has a hydrophilic head and a hydrophobic tail. And in water, they form these nice bilayers. So the untilted L-alpha liquid crystal phase looks a lot like a smectic A, but it's just two layers thick. Okay? And if you cool it down, at least some materials have a phase transition to a tilted phase called the L-beta prime gel phase. It's a little more complicated than just a tilt because I understand there's a change in the configuration of the tail. So its properties are, it's a little bit more viscous than the smectic A phase, but it has this symmetry that it's tilted like a smectic C. Okay, so these things can have topological defects like those in the smectic C. Okay, so let's look at an experiment. So Linda Hurst is an experimenter at the University of California at Merced, the newest UC campus to our north. And they show some really interesting changes in morphology with temperature. Here is the higher temperature phase, the untilted phase, and they make beautiful bubbles. This is a vesicle. It's a bilayer thick, and it's about, I don't know, 10 microns across or so. And it's got water inside and water outside, and it's nice and smooth and round, just like the bubbles you blow in the backyard with soap. Okay, but once cooled into the tilted gel phase, it took on a very odd shape. I've never blown a bubble of that shape. I don't know if you have. Okay, so they're very jagged looking. I wouldn't necessarily call it fractal, but I would certainly call it crumpled. And so the question is, why would a material go from nice and smooth and round to something is, you know, got protrusions and corners? What could possibly be going on? Okay. So the question is, why is the vesicle becoming disordered in shape? And by the way, she did a leakage assay. They don't always leak. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Even if they don't leak, they're still disordered looking, which is kind of weird. Okay. So the idea is that, well, if it has the symmetry of the smectic C liquid crystal, it can have positive and negative defects. It's a sphere, that's G equals zero. So we know it has to have at least two. Okay, adding up to a charge of plus one, but it could have extra plus minus pairs in addition to that. Okay, so defects could lead to non-spherical shapes. Yes?
You stress the transition from the untilted to the tilted state.
Yes.
Is this simultaneously a transition from a liquid to a gel?
It certainly has some change of rheological properties. It's called the gel phase, but I don't know too much about it, like all the details.
Gel is a solid equivalent.
Yeah.
But it doesn't crack exactly. I mean, it can tilt or, I mean, it can leak or not leak. So it's still compliant.
Leaking, you mean large holes? Because water permeable
water
is there anyway. This is always.
Yeah. Okay, but she put a dye on the water on the inside, and she sees how quickly it comes out to the outside. So the permeability must be slow enough that if there's no hole, I mean, she uses confocal microscope pictures to see, and sometimes she can actually see a tear in it, right? But sometimes it doesn't tear. Sometimes when it goes through the phase transition, it remains intact, and the fluid inside and the fluid outside mostly stay separate.
But if you need extra surface area to get the crumples, I guess it's no problem to get water in.
I think you're right.
Water out in that case, yeah. And that's osmotic pressure is an issue.
So it probably breaks up the defects.
It could. We don't know. So in order to try to figure out what's going on with the tilt field, Linda Hurst put lardan into the lipid. So she could then use fluorescence polarization microscopy to look at the orientation. And she was pretty sure that there was a lot of variation in the tilt direction on the surface. It's hard though, because she's only looking at surfaces. So let's just look at what happens to the to a vesicle with defects. Well, Greg Huber, who I don't know if he's here today, but he's got an NSF review coming up on Friday, so he's kind of busy. Greg Huber worked on this problem, and the question is, well, if you have a spherical vesicle and it's got a couple of topological defects, what shape should it be?
They said it should be
the shape of a zucchini, right? It should have tighter curvature where the positive defects are, and that's all. There's only one problem. Linda's experiment doesn't look anything like a zucchini. It looks more like, I don't know, Australia or something, right? It's got a funny shape. It is not by any means an ellipsoid. It's a very complicated shape. So this has got to be the ground state of the system, and it is stuck in a metastable state. So the question is, why could that be? Why would the defects not annihilate? Okay, if I do the XY model on the sphere, I only showed you the incompletely annealed one, but if I anneal it further, you know, on the hard, rigid sphere, all the defects will annihilate till only two are left. And that's not happening in Linda's experiment. So the question is, what's going on? So what we think is going on is that if the defect motion is really fast, so all the extra plus minus pairs that form can pair annihilate, and only two are left, then we'll get something that looks like a zucchini. Okay, but if the defects move really slow, because it is, after all, a gel phase, it's kind of viscous, and the defects may not move very fast, then the extra defects can actually get trapped in some kind of metastable state, and we'll try to understand why that is. So we think it's because the defects actually cause deformation in the vesicle, so that where there's a positive defect, it gets more curved, and where there's a negative defect, it gets less curved, which is to say the Gaussian curvature increases or decreases in response to the presence of the defects.
So it looks like the surface to volume ratio would change quite a bit.
Let's look at it again.
The sphere is quite happy if that's a minimum area for the...
It doesn't cost anything. But it doesn't cost anything to increase the volume.
Yes. They do. They do diffuse. I mean, it is in the model. So it is a liquid-like. It is a liquid-like membrane, right? Well, I'm still treating it as it's basically.
And it's not very well. So the lipid bilayer community abuses the word gel.
Exactly.
It's everything from a crystal to a plastic.
No, but I mean, it should be much slower diffusion at
all. It's still evolving in shape, though. So I think it's not rigid. So the question is, if as a computational theorist, if I wanted to model that process, the first thing I would think of is a molecular scale simulation. Here's just some random molecular scale simulation of a lipid bilayer. And the problem is, if you figure out how many molecules there are in a 10 micron diameter sphere, it's too many to do a full molecular scale simulation. Even the coarse grain models that are out there, you would think if there's one coarse grain particle per molecule, there's no way this is going to work. Even if I substitute one of these complicated things with a 3D potential, it's not going to happen. So molecular dynamics with a full molecular representation can only model a very small flat patch, no defects in it, no curvature, nothing, okay? So to model a whole vesicle, we have to use a really, really, really coarse-grained approach. So what I did was take a really simple model, another model that was in the literature, by a guy named Ju Li. I think he's quite famous in the computational material science community. He's at MIT. And he was interested in making, he was a postdoc with Subra Suresh when Suresh was at MIT. And they were trying to make a mechanical model of the cell. And they wanted the simplest possible model of the cell membrane. So he and his coworkers invented this really interesting model. It looks like a cherry tomato with a toothpick. So it's a point mass, and it has a vector degree of freedom. And he set up an interatomic potential such that the two such particles would attract nicely when they're side by side, and they would repel if they're on top of each other. So if you put these particles randomly in space, randomize their orientations, and let them evolve, they will aggregate into a liquid pancake. Okay, and he had to soften the form of the attraction. If you use a Leonard Jones type potential, they will crystallize really easily. So they softened it to like a, instead of 6-12, more of a 4-8 potential. So the bottom of the well is a little softer and they stay liquid-like in the pancake. They don't crystallize easily. Okay, so we took that model and we basically superimposed the XY model on top of the liquid membrane by adding another degree of freedom. So if you're thinking about the cherry tomato with the toothpick, you have to put an American flag on the toothpick. Okay, that's the special direction, which is like my XY spin. It represents the tilt direction. Okay. I've actually found these at the store. People use them to decorate their food on the 4th of July at a picnic, right? So with that extra spin, we have now another degree of freedom, which is like an XY model. So there's the CI.CJ. And there's a coupling term which tells us basically how much curvature is induced by the presence of a topological defect. So here's a molecular simulation. This thing has got a positive defect and a negative defect, and it's evolving in time. Okay, so there's the details of the potential. Nobody wants to look at that, but if you need it, I'll be happy to give it to you. So what happens is we start with a simulation of about 100,000 of these coarse grain particles in a perfect sphere, and then we set all the spins that represent the tilt directions to random, you know, between 0 and 2 pi, everywhere in space, and then quench the system. And it doesn't stay round. It gets a little pointy and a little disordered. So this is supposed to mimic the transition to the gel phase. I'll show you in a movie in a second. If we make a very small system and all the extra defect pairs annihilate, sure enough, we get a nice prolate body. It doesn't exactly look like a zucchini. I don't know what fruit that looks like. A kiwi, you think it looks like a kiwi? Yeah, that's about right. So it's got a plus defect there and a plus defect there and nothing else. And it looks a little bit like this shape. It's molecular dynamics with a coarse grain potential. We did not do anything to keep the volume constant inside the body. In this model, we always use that expression. Solvent is implicit, which means we're too lazy to model the solvent. There's no solvent. Solvent's invisible. Jonathan's shaking his head. Well, if we put a lot of solvent in there, it would take too much computer time. So we just, the way Julie developed his model, the solvent is absent. So we have techniques for constraining the volume on the inside if we want to, but as you said, these things can leak, and so we didn't think it was legitimate to constrain the volume, so we let the volume fluctuate as it likes. So that's what happens if you just have two plus one defects in the end. Okay, but what happens if you have more defect pairs? So here's how we're gonna visualize this system. We're trying to mimic Linda Hirst's microscopy. She's viewing the system through one polarizer, so instead of having four brushes, a plus one defect has two black brushes because it's just seen through a polarizer. For color, so this is just looking at two hemispheres, we call it red is further from the center of mass and blue is closer to the center of mass. So where the particle, where the part of the sphere looks red, it means it's protruding a little bit. Where it's black, it's a little bit flatter. So I'm going to show you the movie of how this simulation, by the way, the guy who did these simulations was a brilliant graduate student named Jun Geng, who left physics and went to work as a quantitative analyst for Wall Street, actually in Chicago. I hope he's happy. He seems to be. Anyway, so here you can see, wherever you see two defects, you know, see those brushes, that's a defect pair annihilation. So what happens is as the system evolves, the number of defects goes down as defects are pair annihilating, but a few get stuck. And what happens is you end up with a positive defect. So this red region is protruding a bit, positive defect gets trapped in the protruding area, okay? And that's like a place where the minus defects won't go. Yes, Aparna.
I didn't understand something basic, Robin. So if I look at the potential that we had, I understand that we form a 2D membrane, and the membrane folds on itself to form a vesicle. Why?
Well, there's two ways of doing it. One way is that Julie formulated the model so you could add another term that says the neighboring vector, which represents the local layer normal, wants to have a little bit of splay. So the energy is lower when it has a little bit of splay, and it will spontaneously nucleate into a vesicle.
But then there's a characteristic size.
Then there's a characteristic size. In this case, we did not assume that there was a characteristic size. We just set the system up in a vesicle of a given size. And in principle, the system could lower its energy by breaking into a flat plane, but it's stuck in the vesicle state. Like it didn't burst and form into a pancake.
How do you measure curvature? You probably need some energy.
I think if you look at each point and its neighbors, there might be six or there might be more. You can add up all the internal angles and use that as a measure of the curvature.
Just by
geometry. Right. I'll run the move. We were calculating the Gaussian curvature. But actually, that's not what's plotted here. So the grayscale is just showing you molecular orientation for the tilt direction. And here color is just showing you the distance from the origin. So you're going to have to see the curvature with your eyes, and you can see the red part is like protruding. That part is protruding. The plus defects prefer the red areas, and the minus defects prefer the blue areas. And so what I would say is it's a combination of things, that the positive defects are inducing formation of positive Gaussian curvature, negative defects are flattening the system. And what that does is it screens the interaction of positive and negative defects so they won't paranihilate completely. And so some are trapped.
So the density of defects is something you set to the beginning?
No, we start the system with random orientation of every spin vector. And so the defects just form and they start annihilating, but they don't all annihilate. So in the end, we trapped 10 defects, 6 positive and 4 negative. So you have to have a net charge of plus 2 because it's a sphere. Okay? No, they don't. They really do seem to be stuck. Because the thing is not a sphere, the positive defects stay in the tight Gaussian curvature. They have a if you had a rigid sphere, the defects would all annihilate in time. They would just diffuse around until they found each other and para-annihilate. Okay, but on this thing, the point is that they don't because this trapping behavior. Now, Jonathan is doing some other theoretical work on trying to understand how this screening takes place and why they don't para-annihilate. Linda Hirsch tells me she's left these vesicles for, I don't know, hours, and they don't become spheres. What I'd really like to see, though, is if she could use laser tweezers to grasp this disordered-looking vesicle and give it a little pull. That pull should be, if it doesn't burst, should be enough to get the system to its stable state. All the extra defects would annihilate until only 2 are left, and then it would look like a zucchini or maybe a kiwi.
If they can move.
If they can move in the time that you pull it, right? If they're stuck, then nothing will happen. So
you can calculate resistance length from your as well.
I think we could. We did not, unfortunately, but we could now.
So you're given a normal biological system, you measure the resistance length normally, and then you try something like that.
Soka, did you have a comment?
Yes,
this is moving freely. So we have these coarse grain particles using our augmented version of Julie's model. Okay, so it's basically like a fluid XY model. Every spin is now on a free particle that can move freely in 3D space and interact with all its neighbors. The reason that is a result of their interparticle interactions of the coarse grain model. Now, in this case, each so-called particle is not a molecule. It's like a huge patch of membrane. So I would prefer to look at this as a statistical mechanics person of just saying, what happens if you put an XY model on a fluid membrane? It's not necessarily a real lipid model. It's
actually a Brownian dynamic simulation of these balls with sticks.
It's molecular dynamics. So it has momentum, and it has a thermostat. So we could actually heat it, and at the high temperature, it would be in a disordered phase. So it would just be a pancake with zero net local magnetization. And then at low temperature, it's in this. It doesn't have true long range order, but it should have at least reasonably good order. So the simulation was only 100,000 particles, and even that, you know, even with the resources of the Ohio Supercomputer Center, go Ohio, we couldn't do something much bigger than that because it took a lot of hours to run on the cluster. But we have the idea that if you did a much larger system, you would trap a lot more than 10 defects, and that might explain the funny picture. So this work was published in PNAS in 2013. There's the link, and you can just viewed it from specific angles. That very angry looking red pimple is where one of the plus defects is, right? And these are just pointing out the cusps and the shapes, and Linda went and compared those to her experiment. So if you want the full details, you can go look at the PNAS paper. So now I want to switch to talking about pneumatic elastomers, because those are active matter, and we're here to talk about active matter. Okay, it's not cytoskeletons and it's not cells. So here's a picture, a little movie from the Naval Research Lab from Ratna and Jawad Nasiri's lab. It's a pretty old picture. The liquid crystal elastomer is this little clear sliver of polymer in the middle there. This coil is alternately heating and not heating the material, so its temperature is going up and down. So the question is, which is the hot state, the short or the long? And what's interesting is that, you know, my mom taught me when I was little that, you know, hot things expand. But in this particular case, the hot state is actually the short state, and the cold state is the long state. Okay, so pneumatic elastomers are polymers that have an isotropic pneumatic transition. There's also smectic elastomers that you've worked on, right? And they undergo these huge strains. It can be a factor of 4 in length. And they could be used as some kind of artificial muscle. So this is an example of a type. Would you call this active matter, Christina? Maybe sort of, kind of.
To continue this discussion, we had this at the very beginning. If an elastic material is something that's microscopically internally driven versus something that's externally driven, here you could say it's internally driven
It's always, all elastic is driven by entropy, right? It's all about temperature and entropy, about how many states there are for the polymer.
That's what characterizes softness. So I would not call it that, but that's okay.
Well, it's now, what I think is funny is that they always seem to lift office products. You'll see they have these paper clips. Here they have the little binder clip. They make them go up and down. They have a good sense of humor. Or you can see they're using a binder clip to hold the sample up there. Okay, so artificial muscles. So what are they really? And the answer is, well, they're polymers.
Okay,
and whether the material is an elastomer or just a polymer network depends on how cross-linked it is. So those materials that have those huge strains are pretty rubbery. They're elastomers, and they could either be side chain. So what you're supposed to get from this cartoon is that there's these liquid crystal-like particles, these long, skinny rod-like particles, molecules, that are either dangling off the main chain of the polymer, or they're all dangling off here. So this is a side chain pneumatic elastomer. And in the isotropic state, you expect the long axis of all those molecules. It's an isotropic state. You cool it down, they spontaneously align, and they actually drag the polymer chains with them and strain the polymer. So the isotropic pneumatic transition involves a big change of shape of the material.
Okay.
There's also main chain pneumatic elastomers, where it looks more like sausages in a rope, and they can also go through a pneumatic to isotropic transition. And you can also have a gel where the liquid crystal is just kind of in a gel in the polymer and not really attached to it. And all these materials undergo shape change with temperature. Okay, so the question is, if we want to use these things as some kind of actuator and we want it to change its shape in a prescribed way, how can we do that? Well, so let's call that a programmable material, a material that's going to go through a programmed shape change. One way to do that is just to combine two different materials. So in the thermostat over there, there's probably a bimetallic strip, at least an old-fashioned thermostat. You have two different kinds of metal in, two layers, and they have different thermal expansion coefficients. So as the temperature goes up and down, the curvature of the bimetallic strip changes, and that's an indication to your thermostat to turn the heat on and off. We can also do this with pneumatic elastomers by putting a material that's an elastomer on one side and kind of a regular polymer or some other material on the other side, and then it would change its curvature too. But it's also interesting, we can actually engineer different microstructures into a pneumatic elastomer and make it move in all kinds of interesting ways, including putting topological defects in. So for instance, if you have a material that has the long axis of the liquid crystal molecules aligned perpendicular to the surface, we would call that homeotropic anchoring. That's what liquid crystal scientists call that. And then planar anchoring, parallel to the surface on the top layer. Then when you change the temperature, this material is going to change its length along the director on the top. So for instance, if you heat it, it might shrink along the top direction, or if you cool it, it would expand on that direction, and the opposite on the other one, right? And so the thing that starts out as a simple shape would become a complicated shape. It might curl. Okay, and we can do much more interesting things. So let me bring in the word blueprinted. I learned that word from Mark Warner and Eugene Terentyev. Other people have worked on it. The idea is that we can put a non-uniform director patterned into a liquid crystal elastomer. How do we do that? Well, we can sandwich it between patterned substrates and form, actually cross-link the polymer with the liquid crystal between patterned substrates, and the pattern of the substrates will actually pattern the director. Bye. See you tomorrow, I hope. And also, we can put chiral dopant in the liquid crystal and make a twist between the two substrates, all kinds of interesting things we can do. And then if you cross-link the material when that director is present, you've blueprinted that texture into the material. You've polymerized it in. And so we can actually blueprint different ways. The simplest thing is just, for instance, to have a twist along or a splay and that's all between the top and the bottom, but otherwise uniform in the system. We can do a two-dimensional thing where we actually put a topological defect into the cell. We can even do three-dimensional things where you have, for instance, different domains with different twists, and they all do all kinds of interesting things. Okay, so there's lots of experiments, and we've been collaborating with different experimental groups. The way we're studying them is using continuum level modeling, not molecular scale. This is finite element simulation. The only other physicist I know who's written a finite element simulation is Jim's son, Steve Langer, who's written some beautiful finite element code over at NIST. Right? So this is a simple 3D sample here that's just been meshed in tetrahedral volume elements. We describe the state of the system through its strain. You have to use more than just the linear form of the strain. You actually need the Green Lagrange strain, which has those higher order terms in order to make this code work. And we also have to describe the imprinted, you know, that blueprinted pneumatic director field through some kind of vector field in the system. And we use the pneumatic order tensor as a function of position to describe the state of the director when the material's cross-linked. The free energy density has one term that's just an elastic energy, so and then one term that describes the coupling between the strain and the pneumatic order. I will skip all the details. I will also say, just because Roscoe is here, that this is a homemade code implemented in CUDA on a GPU-enabled computer, which means we can run the code really fast, and we don't even need a cluster. We can run it on a single machine. So the simplest thing is to put a plus one defect in. And Mark Werner and his postdoc Carl Modes had the idea that if you have a, depending on the sign of the defect, you could get a cone or an anti-cone. So here's just a couple of simulations showing that. So here's the formation of the cone. You can see the simulation is a little bit underdamped because it flops around a little bit. And here's the anti-cone. And it makes a saddle. So plus one defect generates positive Gaussian curvature, minus one defect generates negative Gaussian curvature. The difference between this system and the one I showed you what made of lipid is that in this case, the defects cannot move. They are like anchored into the material, but they can't go anywhere. Okay?
Well,
yes?
I didn't notice from free energy whether that has a soft degree
of freedom or not. It does. And so, actually, no. The issue here is these materials are blueprinted, which means the director is glued into the sample. We have done other models where we let where the material is less cross-linked, where the director can rotate, and then if you start with the director north-south and you pull, you get striping. We've modeled that. I can show you. Yes. The QIJ zero. So that is telling us that's a function of position, and that tells us what we've glued to the material for the director. And so when it increases, when you change the temperature, it's going to change its length. It's going to strain preferentially so that it will get longer and shorter along the director axis there. So QIJ zero is just the pneumatic order tensor. It's a tensor representation of the director field. Okay. So. How about if I show you this movie? So this is a slightly tighter mesh, so you can see in a finite sample what happens with the plus defect. And you can see it has to basically pop through when the scalar order parameter drops. So the plus one defect is right at the corner, and it ends up as a cone. Now, as it happens, Tim White, who's an experimenter at the Air Force Lab in Dayton, to our west from Kent, and his postdoc, Mike McConney, have actually been generating these things. So here is, it looks a little bit from the top like a volcano, and that's comparison to our simulation. And actually, this paper has come out now. And Dick Brower's group, Dahan is a PhD student in that group, have also made plus one defects. Here it's just supported on a little tube there, so it looks almost like a tulip or like a flower. And you can see it looks a lot like our simulations as well. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that Tim White's group has decided to make higher order defects. They've gone as far as plus 10 and minus 10. So here's an example of a minus 2 defect. So this is, if you take your pen, you can rotate it around and see that it's a minus 2. And when they heat it, it looks like what would happen if you threw the plastic from your sandwich onto the pond. It looks kind of wrinkled, but it actually has some sort of complex structure. What's interesting about these materials is that there's a fundamental front-back symmetry because the director is uniform through the sample. And so you would expect that these little features might pop up sometimes and down sometimes. In the simulation, they were doing that more or less at random. It turns out when they heat the material over at the Air Force, they actually shine the heat gun from one side. And so we actually ran the simulation so that we heat one side first and then the other, and that breaks the symmetry so it pops up. I think this looks like something you would make orange juice out of. Right, it has a bump in the middle and little ridges around the edge. Okay, so actually Tim White calls this topography from topology, right, because it's just changing the height. So the idea here is that you could actually build any microstructure you want in order to get a shape. Okay, so for instance, if you put an array of defects, so here's an array of plus one defects, these things will pop up into all different types of shapes. So you could make textures. Here are some single defects that have different numbers of emerging stripes, and you can see all different types of structures that can generate from that. Okay, so we're at the stage now where Tim White can send us one of these arrays. We can simulate it, and he writes this pattern onto the front and back substrates, puts the liquid crystal monomer mixture inside, cross-links it between the pattern substrates, and generates pictures kind of like that. It's a little more complicated for him, though, because it's hard to support those little thin pieces of plastic. He generally floats them on water. Okay, now, Carl Modes, working with Mark Warner, had the idea that you could actually do auto origami. You could pattern some director field that would cause this thing, when you heat it, to change into a folded shape. So the idea is here, these are the director there, and this should make a nice little corner. He cut out the whole of the corner so it wouldn't have a stress concentration there and rip itself to smithereens. And the problem is the bending energy is such that it doesn't make sharp creases. So we're still working on that. Here's two corners trying to fold into part of a cube. And here is three corners, well, more corners, trying to fold into a whole cube. And we can't get quite high enough strains. So we're still working on the auto origami.
So here the pneumatic structure does not change.
The pneumatic structure stays fixed.
Which is correct or not?
It depends how strongly cross-linked the material is. Okay, let's see if there's anything else I want to show you. Well, I can show you some fun little devices we've been working on. This is a slit in a film that opens and closes with temperature. Dick Brewer's group has actually built it. Here's a model that my student Andrew Konya made up. It's the idea of having a hole, for instance, in a membrane. If you were going to have a sieve, you could have the holes be small when the material is cold, and it will catch all the stuff that you want to catch in your membrane and your filter. And then you put it to a different place, you turn on the hot water, all the pores open up and the junk will go out, and then you've reset your filter for the next time. So you can have devices that respond to temperature. I would also like to say about the Tim White elastomer, he's actually put an azo dye in the material, and so instead of changing its temperature, you can also actuate it just by shining light on it. And the light actually induces a change from pneumatic to isotropic. Three-dimensional fields. I think I want to skip this stuff. Since we are at the active matter conference, I wanted to show you some work that was inspired by Christina Amparna that is not done yet, but in the spirit of, and I've been thinking about it for a couple years now and haven't. Well, we're hoping to make some progress, but I thought I would just show it to you because it's fun and interesting. So on the category of flocking and behavior animals, I was inspired by the V-check model. I thought it's very beautiful, but I wanted to make a model that was more mechanical, that had real crawling. Okay, so here's some pictures of caterpillars. So caterpillars crawl by stretching and shrinking and with traction forces on the substrate. And so the question is, how do crawling caterpillars make patterns? Okay, so I have to make like the statistical mechanics model of a caterpillar. So what I decided, because here's a real caterpillar, so I had to take 9 soft spheres that can partially overlap. I wanted to connect them with springs, and the springs get shorter and longer. Okay, if there were no friction, the whole caterpillar would just stay in its center of mass, wouldn't move, and it would just get shorter and longer. So to make it crawl, I have to give it friction forces. I give it both static and kinetic friction. So what happens is the tail, there's actually a picture. The tail grabs the substrate, okay? Actually, in this case, the head grabs the substrate, the whole thing shrinks, then the tail grabs the substrate, and the head slides forward. So it's a shrink and a grow, and that's like a two-stroke walking procedure. And as luck would have it, the same summer we were fooling around with this model, someone actually did a whole paper about how caterpillars walk, and it looks more or less like that. So
that's what we're doing.
Okay, so the spheres interact with each other between worms with just the soft part of the soft repulsive part of the Leonard Jones potential. It has a special name, the Weeks Chandler Anderson potential. I postdoc with John Weeks, so I like to use his potential. It's just the whole Leonard Jones potential cut off at the minimum and shifted up.
So it's
short range and it's repulsive. There are no attractive forces. To make it look more like real caterpillars, we gave it a distribution of crawling speeds. We gave them some instinct that they should change the direction of their motion from time to time. The model is overdamped, no ice skating caterpillars, and the model can be polar or apolar. The particles can move in a single direction, because after all, caterpillars have a head that's different from their tail. Or we could also make it move back and forth. Yes?
Sorry, how can you attenuate and model the interaction with the substrate? You said it grabs
the head can grab the substrate while the tail slides, and then the tail grabs the substrate while the head slides. And it's overdamped, so velocity is always proportional to force.
So there is some potential, some force?
I would call it grabbing. So it means,
anchor.
I mean anchoring. So it means that during that part of the motion, the velocity of that bead is not allowed. It has to be zero.
Okay,
so that's what grabbing means. Or in the computer program, if V greater than zero, V equals zero. Right? So that's what it does. It just holds still.
Coordinated with the shrinking and expansion.
Yes. So while it's expanding, the tail is holding, and while it's shrinking, the head is holding. So it's and there's also, in addition to the nearest neighbor springs connecting the caterpillar together, if that's all I had, it could have any angle of bend, and that's not realistic. So I added second neighbor springs to resist bend. Okay, so we have to see a movie. So I'm sorry, it's not a very high quality movie. I can show you some more. But the colors just are to tell them apart so they don't look like a big mess. They all started the same direction and they quickly organized themselves into rivers.
I'm sorry, but what's the interaction between
short range repulsive.
Between the different
short range repulsive.
No attraction.
No attraction. But when they run into each other, their beads kind of get on, you know, because they're all the same length. They're out of phase, though, but somehow they still tend to stick together. Let me run that again. Looks a little better on my screen than on here. I don't know why that is. But you can see. That's a mechanical effect. I did not put that into the model. It's just from steric interaction. Yes. Well, it's not a friction force. It's just the force of the interaction. So they repel. But if you think about one caterpillar going past another one, they have to overcome some energy barrier for their beads to bump over each other.
And this direction changing is relatively slow compared to...
Here they're polar. They're only going in one direction. But some of them end up going west when everybody else is going east.
That keeps them together, right? Once together, they wouldn't splay off by random.
Well, they do every now and then. I can run that one more time. So here they start out all going parallel, but they have some random forces that cause them to change direction at random. And from time to time, some end up going the other way.
Let's see something else.
These are semi-flexible.
Even if the individual entity was rigid, you will still get this undulation on some long legs.
Okay.
Do you start from the exit in the same direction?
Yes, they all started going east on the screen. This is a simulation that Aparna suggested. We took some dead worms and used them to make V-shaped barrier. So we have now a hard boundary condition, a hard wall on the left, a hard wall on the right, and periodic boundary conditions up and down. It's a 2D simulation. And what's interesting, and we started the particles on the left side red, the ones on the right side blue, and these are not polar. They can just reverse their direction constantly. And what we find is that the particles tend to more often go from left to right than right to left. So this is a rectifying barrier. So this model shows rectification. Right. And what's interesting is, you know, these guys have aligned with the wall over here, and these guys have aligned with the wall over here, but there's, even in this tiny little system, enough particles that they, that more of them end up on the right and fewer of them end up on the left. Let's see. I also want to show you this movie. This is what I was putting up before. This is a simple model of crawling done with a finite element simulation. And this is something like the crawling caterpillar. It's supposed to represent the pneumatic elastomer, where the head and the head is hot, and then, or sorry, the head is expanding, and then the tail is expanding. The head and the tail are out of phase. And the experiment I saw, so here I've also put it on a sine wave substrate, which is hidden, and you can see it crawling over. So as we were talking about all those models of crawling cells and the stresses they generate, the thought occurred to me that I could use a model of this type to study motion. And so that's something I'm hoping to get accomplished in the 2 weeks that I'm here.
Okay.
I think I should stop because our time is almost up. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
So what's going on is that the director is parallel to the long axis of the worm, and the scalar order parameter is going like sine kx minus omega t, where k is such that the head and tail are out of phase.
So it's internally driven.
Internally driven. And so the experiment that I saw, Jake Fontana, who was a graduate student at LCI, took a piece of elastomer, put it on rubbed velvet, and took a heat source and kind of stroked it over the elastomer, and it crawls. So in that case, the directional friction comes from the velvet. In real caterpillars, it comes from the little setae that are the little fibers on its belly that allow it to drag forward but dig in if it tries to go backwards. And here it's just if V less than zero, V equals zero, right? It's not allowed to go backwards. And that allows it to slide forwards.
If you have a side chain elastomer, what really prevents them from moving from rotating?
Cross-linking. So
cross-linking, but this main chain is cross-linked, but these things are hanging.
As far as I know, if the polymer is heavily enough cross-linked, we can't really call it an elastomer anymore. The experimenters call it a liquid crystal polymer network. Then under heating and cooling, it only strains by a few percent, not by 400%. And in that case, the director really seems to be blueprinted into the solid. Doesn't rotate much, or perhaps not at all, relative to the body. But it's the lower cross-linked materials that have those huge strains on temperature where we expect that soft elastic response. I can show you our models if you want. Mm-hmm.
The part where you show the shapes and patterns that are formed in the instrument, what is the range of the temperature between all that part? Because as far as I know, the elastomer maybe only works in a very small range of temperature.
Well, the ideal thing is to go through the isotropic pneumatic transition or be close to it. I have, in my simulations, what I do is I just vary the scalar order parameter. What I saw in Tim White's lab is he basically takes, you know, the light source or the heat gun and just shines it on the thing. I didn't have a good measure of local temperature that he could show me. But probably in his papers it does say. So I can find his paper and help you answer the question, because I don't know off the top of my head what the temperature range is. But from the point of view of trying to build a robot, you really don't want to actuate your robot's muscles by heating them and cooling them, because then you take it to Ohio and it won't work. It's too cold. Right? Listen, the cars barely start at minus 12, but they do. So it would be better to actually actuate things with electric field. And pneumatics won't do that. They don't actuate with an electric field, but maybe a smectic would. Peter?
In the first part, we looked at these twinkling vesicles. What did you have for
kappa bar
in your simulation?
So
you must have had a
diet
for
kappa
bar. Is it
kappa bar is the preferred radius?
Kappa bar is the modulus that controls gas and vapor.
Okay.
For bending modulus. So
presumably
you could tweak things.
That comes out of the interparticle potential.
Right.
And I think if we look back at Julie's model, they have a translation. at his original paper. So the attractive interaction and the angular part would give you, so first of all, the version of the code that we used, its equilibrium state is flat. It doesn't have a preference for curvature, but there's an energy cost for curvature.
Right. The question is it kappa bar that comes out of it positive or negative? And then, because one sign prefers negative Gaussian curvature.
The way we ran the model, I believe it prefers flat curvature. But we didn't have anything in the model that gives it, breaks the symmetry. But
kappa bar always prefers either positive or negative, not zero.
Oh. Jonathan,
kappa
do you know?
Prefers zero.
You have a Gaussian theorem, right? You don't change topology. So you
yeah, sure. You don't change total topology. But locally, if you have a very high kappa bar, you could get all sorts of things happening.
Maybe you could help us figure out how to put that into the coarse grain model, because I don't know.
It's not in right now.
It's not in.
Well,
okay.
There's some value in it.
But wait, if you want an asymmetry between the inner layer and the outer layer.
But that's not what Kappa Bar is telling you about.
What is that telling you?
If the asymmetry between inside and outside layer is just a spontaneous curvature.
Right.
But Kappa Bar is
when you get saddles or
okay. It's not in the model at present. But maybe we can find a way to put it in.
It isn't. It must be valid.
Some value, but
right. Zero.
Because right now, if you just put those particles with random 3D positions and let them aggregate, they aggregate into a pancake.
They don't
form. Actually, that's not
entirely true.
You should measure it from the
simulation.
We made some more
variations on Julie's model, the smart student Jin Geng did. And so he made a version of the model where we could actually coarse grain the inner leaflet and the outer leaflet of the bilayer separately.
And then we put mixtures
on the inner layer and outer layer of two different types of particles
and watch the phase separation. And there was enough coupling between the two layers that
whatever chemical separation happened on one leaflet kind of automatically happened on the neighboring leaflet.
They had strong interactions just from
the mechanics of curvature,
which I thought was pretty cool. So that's Julie
developed a really great model. I'm not sure if he's doing a lot of stuff with it right now, but it's useful for a lot of different types of mechanics of membranes. So, I mean, our tilted version is just, yes.
So you're talking about trying to find nice standard systems in your X-ray modeling, rising modeling, you're saying, like biology. I think for worms, you wouldn't use a caterpillar, you'd use C. elegans or something like that. I wonder, do worms crawl the same way?
No, an inchworm, well, if this were the playground, I might get down on the floor. An inchworm goes up off
the table, right?
It has a Z. Everything I'm doing is in the plane, and so the fact that the worm changes its length is really important, but that's really what caterpillars seem to do. They have some sort of pistoning model. I have no idea what C. elegans does. Does it do this?
There is this long body muscles that sort of twist and flex.
So the question is, how do I put that into a finite element model if I want to have a continuous body that's doing that? Or how do I put it into my masses and springs model to mimic the C. elegans?
The muscles are not really contracting. So the way you should be able to do it is just coordinated between inside and outside. It's not this longitudinal contraction, but it's
flexible. Basically, it bends the same way as your pneumatic elastomer. You just have to contract on this side and expand on the other side.
Yeah, okay, you know what? How about if I make two rows of beads side by side, so like a double? Interesting.
Especially on how it goes through the ground and stuff like
that. I also remember There was a talk at the March meeting called Snakes on a Plane, which is a joke on the movie title about how snakes actually crawl. But presumably they didn't study swarming of snakes. That would be a little frightening. But they actually put, if I remember, they put like plastic sleeves on the snake and showed how the snake crawls when it has no friction. You know, so snakes actually change their gait. Anyway, are they doing cookies at 3? Because if so, we probably missed them.
It's Tuesday, so I think not because there is a physics school open,
right? Oh, no cookies on Tuesday? Did we get an email? Did anybody get an email saying cookies?
On Tuesday, there's a physics school open.
No cookies?
No, why does it have to be cookies?
No.
But there are no cookies Wednesday.
No cookies on Tuesdays. Well, let me, well, there's always computers in your, I mean, there's always cookies in your computer. But what I wanted to say is I'm here until a week from Friday, so I'm happy to talk with anyone about things to do with any of these models that might be useful or helpful, or to give me ideas for things I should do. So thank you very much.
Thank you.